We have four cases on for argument today. First case is number 2009-3237, Tudor against the Department of the Treasury. Mr. Berger,
yes, thank you. Ready.
Good morning, Your Honors.
How are you?
Mr. Tudor, who's the petitioner here, suffered an adverse action because, according to the findings of the board, he improperly referred tax cases to the U.S. Attorney's Office for prosecution without authority. We know that Mr. Tudor, at all relevant times, was a criminal investigator for the Internal Revenue Service. The reasoning of the judge in the board decision was that Mr. Tudor had authority to initiate cases, but not to refer cases in his capacity as a group supervisor.
Did the AJ actually decide that he did have authority with regard to the initiation of cases?
Well, I'm looking at his...
I thought that what the ALJ said was that thus, even if specs 1 through 35 are unfounded, so it was like a hypothetical.
The issue concerning the misconduct charge, concerning the improper initiation of cases, was not sustained by the board. And so it didn't survive for review here. The only narrow issue that was sustained by the board was the referral authority. We know that the Dallas field office, where Mr. Tudor functioned, had an unusual arrangement with respect to referral of prosecutions, although the agency had a standing rule that only the special agent in charge had the exclusive authority to refer cases, that authority was delegated down to the ASAP.
I assume we agreed with you, sir, that the 2 points on page 8 of the AJ's opinion, where the AJ says Lasecki specifically testified that he never authorized referrals, said it twice. Let's assume that testimony simply is not in the record, which is what you aver, and I've listened to the tapes. I can't find it anywhere in there. So let's assume that you take those two lines out of the opinion because they're just wrong. What's next? What happens?
Then there's no substantial evidence to support the finding of the board that it was improper for Mr. Tudor to refer those cases.
As I understand it, now correct me if I'm wrong about the state of the record, but as I understand it, the various memorandums of interview and the report of the investigation were part of the record before the administrative judge. Is that true?
They were, Your Honor, but not referenced at all in his decision,
no,
nor were
I
they relied upon.
That. I understand that, but they are in the record and therefore were available to the administrative judge for consideration in determining whether the case was made out against Mr. Tudor.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Including the admissions, as reported at least, of Mr. Tudor, which admissions seem at odds with, or at least in tension with, his testimony. Admissions I'm referring to, just so we're all on the same page, the admissions, I guess, if you have the red appendix there, do you have that yet?
Yeah, page 46, Your Honor.
Pages, particularly on pages 71 and 74, this was, a memorandum of interview.
Okay.
Number 6 on page 71, Mr. Tudor stated that he never received verbal permission to refer investigation, and then he later down on number 11, he had authority on with respect to one investigation, but generally not. And then on 74, I believe, he never received verbal permission in the last paragraph to refer investigations to the department. The question would be, why isn't that evidence substantial evidence, acknowledging that the administrative judge didn't specifically rely on that, but why wouldn't that be sufficient to constitute substantial evidence in support of the decision?
I have two responses. One, with all due respect to the court, I don't believe the court has the jurisdiction to examine the internal memoranda of the agency because your jurisdiction is confined to review of the board decision. It's only the board decision that is here for your review.
Well, but if the board decision was a decision predicated on a record that included this evidence, then this evidence is before us because that comes up to us as part of the record on appeal.
I would agree, but the judge's findings are confined entirely to the testimony of Mr. Lisinski, the SAC. He makes no reference at all to any of the agency internal memoranda.
Well, I think Ms. King, I believe, does refer to Mr. Lisinski, the interview of Mr. Lisinski in any event, right? In her testimony?
Vaguely, yes. Without, it's not particularized in any way. And the judge himself doesn't in any way particularize or make any reference to the record. But I would like to point out on page 46 of the appellee's brief in the appendix, at the very bottom, paragraph 11, Mr. Tudor says, it reportedly says, he's certain he did not willfully or intentionally, in the middle of that paragraph, he did not willfully or intentionally violate policy. It's absolutely untrue. I didn't circumvent the policy. My motivation was to follow the direction of my supervisor, he says. So,
where were you reading? I'm sorry. Was that
at
46?
At page 46, yeah, app 46. Oh, the last paragraph in the middle of that paragraph.
Right, but the immediately preceding paragraph,
yes, it's
of course,
ambiguous.
Is not helpful to Mr. Tudor. In fact, it's pretty damaging. It says that I did not have authority to refer any investigations. I referred cases on my own.
Understood. It's ambiguous, Your Honor.
What does he say right above that? Mr. Tudor stated, I believe I was given verbal authority to refer three investigations.
Understood.
Yeah.
I understand. He's in an interview. He's responding to their questions. He summarizes his state of mind.
Who's writing? Who's typing up the interview?
Apparently, the internal affairs investigators.
And was Mr. Tudor given a copy of these type-ups so he could correct them?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. He's not given a copy in order to review or sign.
Let me go back to the two points in the AJ's opinion that, for purposes of argument, we're going to extract. I take it your argument is that the credibility call that was made against Mr. Tudor was made because of the AJ's belief that Lisinski had testified that he never gave any authority at all.
Correct.
See, because you've got once the AJ makes a credibility call against your client, we can presume that he is almost carrying that adverse credibility ruling across all of Tudor's testimony.
I understand.
So if the credibility determination falls or no basis for it, then we're go back to the record and we would have to credit all of Tudor's sworn testimony.
That's correct. And the only evidence I believe this court has before it that's competent is the testimony at the hearing. There's no other reference.
Well, competent.
I mean, the testimony of Lisinski is actually inconsistent, if you will, in a way, with his preliminary interview. Because in the interview, he said, I can remember maybe five cases of initiation and one referral. And then when he's given the testimony, I believe your adversary who examined Lisinski pushed him on that, and Lisinski said, no, I got a different story here.
That's correct.
I had sort of blanket approval for initiating cases provided that there was follow-up and talk with Taylor. And he said, with regard, a slightly different system with regard to referrals, sort of like the two of them had to work it out.
Right, and there was no effort by the AJ to reconcile the internal memoranda of the agency with testimony at the hearing. And there was no effort to impeach Mr. Lisinski or Mr. Tudor by agency counsel at the hearing either with any alleged inconsistent statements.
But isn't the question whether there's substantial evidence in the record, even though the AJ's opinion may not have made specific findings or may not have made specific statements attempting to reconcile statements, nonetheless, they were considered and the AJ concludes that the first charge is supported based on the evidence of record, the appellant's stipulations at the hearing, and his admissions under oath. And doesn't the standard of review present an obstacle for you?
Well, again, I will reiterate, I don't see where this court has the authority to assess the record, only the board's decision and the evidence that was adduced before the board.
Now, that's the evidence that was adduced before the board, which, of course, includes a lot of this evidence that we've been discussing, which, even though the administrative judge didn't discuss it, is still part of the record and therefore before us. I think we can... I mean, I understand your argument, but I wouldn't put a lot of weight on that contention if
well,
I were you.
Then the record is strewn with ambiguity and inconsistency. We as advocates can only respond to the evidence that's adduced really before the board.
Right.
That's what the cross-examination is all about. Whether an agency itself substantiates misconduct in and of itself, I just don't see that as the role of this court to make an assessment. If the judge himself didn't feel that it was relevant enough, material enough to even make mention, why can this court sit and substitute a de novo judgment?
If this judge had written a one-page, fortunately, the administrative judges, to their credit, often write very lengthy and detailed opinions. But if this judge had written a one-page opinion and said, I've looked at the evidence, I heard the evidence, I think the agency has sustained its case, and you were here, you know, you would not be able to say with any persuasive force that we can't consider evidence that the judge didn't discuss. So I don't think you have much to go on by saying we, for purposes of substantial evidence, we can't look at the entire body of evidence that's before the administrative judge and decide whether that was supported. Now, you may argue fairly that the judge was wrong in, for example, his characterization of Leszczynski's testimony, and that skewed, perhaps significantly skewed, the judge's ultimate conclusion. But that's a slightly different question from whether we can look at the rest of the evidence in deciding whether there's substantial evidence. You understand that?
I do understand that, Your Honor. I do understand that. But it seems to me that your role is not to sit here and make an assessment de novo. It doesn't appear that the court has the authority to just search the record with a searchlight and find anything out there, no matter where it's located, even if it's not brought up in the course of the board hearing.
Does it matter that at least the report that's on pages 71, 74 seems maybe to have some of its own inconsistencies? I'm looking at paragraph 11, to which the presiding judge drew your attention earlier, where he said he knew he didn't have the authority to initiate the order to refer. He knew that. Now, that may have been he knew he didn't have authority in the statute. The investigations, he believed he was given verbal authority to initiate and refer.
Right. So we have.
So there you've got apparently Leszczynski saying, well, I mean, what I'm asking is whether there's a possibility that when he was asked whether or not he had authority, he was thinking about, he knew that there was no written authority.
There's no
office was violating the Holy Bible.
Right. There's clearly
are there
disputed.
Any other
there's
place,
no standard.
Are there any other places right. in this review where there is this inconsistency?
There's no standard.
Saying I had authority and I didn't.
There was no standing authority whatsoever for him to refer those cases. There was no written policy that authorized him to refer those cases. But there was a deviation. We know there was a deviation because the judge made a finding on page 5 of his decision that there was a deviation. There was a verbal deviation. That's what's so unusual about this. The SAC testified he had verbal authority to deviate from the standing policy and delegate verbal authority to the ASAC down the road.
Yeah, so I don't think there's any real dispute about that.
Yeah, so it's this informal...
It's the scope.
It's true, but how do we define that? And the only evidence that the board considered relevant is the testimony of Mr. Leszczynski, which we believe has been wholly mischaracterized. Whether we can, I look at your statutory, the review authority at US 5 USC 7703, it's only limited to reviewing the final board order.
The final board decision, not necessarily the final board opinion. Those are two different things.
Okay.
Why don't we, we'll save, because we've questioned you heavily, we'll save your rebuttal time.
Yeah.
And okay. We'll hear from the government.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Solomson.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Because substantial evidence in the record supports the MSPB's decision below, this court should affirm the decision sustaining the demotion penalty imposed upon the petitioner, Mr. Tudor.
Is there any substantial evidence that supports the two statements in the opinion on page appendix page 8 with regard to Lisinski's statements that he never authorized appellant to make referrals?
Yes, there are at least two places that support that statement. The first is the statement in the management or inquiry that I believe Judge Bryson referenced before in the government's appendix at page 71, where Mr.
Well, what the AJ refers to at the top of page 8 is testimony by Lisinski, not statements he may have made in the course of the investigation, right?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Well, the word testified is the word that's used.
Then that's in the sentence preceding the one I believe Judge Lynn is referencing.
Well, Judge Lynn, I think, is referencing both sentences.
Yes, both.
The first says that Lisinski testified that he remembered talking with the appellant and that he gave him authority to initiate 4 or 5.
The sentence I'm looking at is, appellant asserts that that he had verbal or implied authority to initiate investigations and referred investigation to the U.S. attorney, and Lisinski testified to the contrary. I don't see any testimony from Lisinski to the contrary. Am I wrong in that?
Well, there is another reference, and that was the second one I was going
well, let's,
to.
Let's focus first
is there
on that
testimony
reference. Is there
the
any
contrary?
Testimony to that effect, or is the AJ simply wrong?
No, I believe that there is testimony
okay,
to that effect.
Point to it, please.
Okay, it's located in, for ease of reference, in the petitioner's brief,
right,
Your Honor, at page 30 to 31, within the brief itself.
The brief itself or the appendix?
In the brief itself is one of the easier places to reference it, although we could look at...
Well, this is all whether they gave authority to initiate. Right?
It's also in the...
We're talking about referrals.
In referrals, the question is, Mr. Tudor is facing the allegation that he initiated or referred under his signature 64 activities. And is it your testimony that you had given him authority to do that on all those cases or only on the 5? And the answer is, I gave him the authority to initiate in only the bulk currency initiative cases, the 5 cases.
Yeah, but it doesn't say anything about referrals.
But the AJ, being there, reasonably interpreted the answer as saying that it is a compound question that drew no objection. And the answer was given... I'll tell you the whole scope of the authority I gave Mr. Tudor.
When he gets to the question of referrals on A65, he says, when cases were referred for prosecution, my instructions to both Mr. Tudor and the ASAC were that would have to be a situation that was discussed with the ASAC. He had authority to presumably act as long as he had the acquiescence of the ASAC.
But Mr. Lisinski there in A65 explicitly contrasts the authority issue with that to initiate investigations. With initiation, Mr. Lisinski said you could talk to the ASAC after you initiate. With respect to the referral, you couldn't go ahead and just refer cases for prosecution, but to the extent you referred cases for prosecution, you had to consult with the ASAC prior to or in conjunction with. So the notion, and keep in mind, please,
testified that he was in constant communication. Pardon me, Tudor testified he was in constant communication with Taylor about this matter.
He did, and he also conceded that he can't say for certain whether the ASAC or Mr. Lisinski actually
knew. You could have very
knew.
Easily called Taylor and asked her the question, right? Taylor wasn't called to testify, right?
That's correct.
So the question on the referral issue was Tudor doing what Lasecki said he could do, which was you can go ahead and do the referral provided you worked it out with Taylor.
Right? But none of that would take away from the fact that this transcript can be interpreted in light of all the other evidence to read it exactly the way the AJ did. The AJ said, I understand Mr. Tudor to be saying.
Well, how does the AJ reconcile the Lasecki's testimony with this data point on page A71 about what happened in an interview when we don't know, you know, who was typing the interview up, and the interview is inconsistent because at one point Tudor says he never had verbal permission and he said he was given verbal authority.
The discrepancy between Mr. Lasecki's interview and the way the AJ interpreted his testimony was over one case.
I'm talking now about Tudor's interview. And you're basically hanging your hat, I think, on the administrative record on the interviews, right?
No. And also, the AJ makes a credibility finding. For example, the AJ says that Mr. Tudor expressed surprise in being asked about the 64 different times that Mr. Tudor had initiated or referred cases for prosecution. That is precisely the type of reason why the AJ is given such almost unreviewable discretion to make credibility determinations, because part of it is a judgment about body language and emotion at the time of the testimony. And it's not just Mr. Tudor, it's not just Mr. Lasecki's testimony. We also have the testimony of Ms. King, of Deborah King, who is the SAC who did the management inquiry.
Now, let me make sure I understand exactly what your position is with respect to this passage that Judge Lynn referred to on A8. Now, you're saying, well, the first reference on line 3 to testimony is not erroneous because it's a compound question. The second reference, where we say that after referring to Lasecki's testimony on about line 10, we say Lasecki specifically stated that he never authorized the appellant to make referrals to the U.S. attorney. Now, you're saying that is not inconsistent with the statement on A65 of the blue appendix because what? Because Lasecki, that the statement stated is not a reference to testimony?
A65.
That's where he said that the referrals could be made as long as they were discussed by the agent in charge.
No, Your Honor, our point with respect to A65 is that Mr. Lasecki is contrasting it with the authority that he gave him to initiate investigations in certain cases.
Right, but the statement that appears in the AJ's opinion on A8 is that Lasecki said he never authorized the appellant to make referrals to the U.S. attorney. That seems to be inconsistent with, I mean, there's no testimony, at least in hic verba, to that effect
in
Lasecki. So that's wrong, correct?
There is no mistake
by the administrative judge.
In defense of the administrative judge, that the statement is not in quotes, but that language does not appear. Lasecki doesn't explicitly testify, I never gave him prosecution authority.
That Absolutely. Or in substance does not say that. This is an important point. That this is a critical point in the case, and if the AJ got it wrong, it seems to me that affects a lot about the way we should view the administrative judge's opinion, don't you think?
But the administrative judge is,
did the administrative judge get that one wrong? Let's just start with that proposition.
Did Mr. Lasecki testify explicitly the way the AJ said no?
Or in substance?
I believe in substance, yes, Your Honor.
Find me the place where in substance he testifies that he never authorized the appellant to make referrals to the U.S. attorney in his testimony.
Well, that is the testimony, I believe, on 65, Your Honor, where he says, where Mr. Berger asked Mr. Lasecki, what about with respect to cases referred for prosecution? Did you have the same arrangement as with the initiation? Not necessarily. he had to speak with or discuss it with the ASAC.
Yeah,
and then on cross,
that's how he gets the authority.
And but he doesn't have this blanket authority. Remember, Mr. Tudor's
testimony. We're not talking about blanket authority. We're talking about any authority at all, because it's the no authority at all point, and that the ALJ is relying on that we're pressing you on.
But Mr. Tudor's claim is that he has complete and total authority. As long as my supervisors kind of knew what was going on, because they kind of knew what was going on. And since they kind of knew what was going on, I had this complete blanket authority. I didn't have to.
What he may have thought his authority was is different from whether or not Lasecki never gave him any authority at all. He may have misunderstood what Lasecki told him he could do. What we're pressing on now is whether or not the board was incorrect when it seemed to have pitched an important part of his decision on the thought that Lasecki had never given any authority of any kind whatsoever to refer.
But even if that statement in the board's decision was completely discounted, we're talking about a discrepancy over a single case, because the only other way to interpret Mr. Lasecki's testimony on cross is that he gave authority.
Mr. Lasecki was not asked by you whether he gave authority only once to refer. I know that was his statement in his interview, that he could only recall once, but I don't believe you pressed him on that issue.
Not me personally, Your Honor.
Well, well, your agency. I know you listened to all the
correct
tapes. Yeah. He wasn't pressed on that.
But he did say, it was a compound question about referral and investigation. And he said, and I only gave him authority in five
cases.
We've
been through that, but then you come to the testimony on A65.
But we also have Mr. Lasecki and Mr. Tudor in the management inquiry and in the IG investigation saying it was at most one case. And we have the testimony of Ms. King testifying that Mr. Lasecki told her never when it came to referrals. So we have the testimony of
which
Ms.
seems
King
at odds with the material in A65.
And that's why this court should give the deference to the AJ it deserves, that she interpreted
if,
the testimony.
If the AJ had said, well, you know, here's what he told Ms. King, but he testified differently at the hearing, but I believe what he told Ms. King is more likely to be true, then you'd be all right. But instead, what the AJ says is he testified that he didn't give authority. And if that's wrong, then it isn't open to you, readily at least, it seems to me, to say, well, he weighed the King statement against his testimony at trial. He concluded, perhaps incorrectly, that his testimony at trial was consistent with the statement he made to Ms. King.
But ultimately, the board's finding below is that the board found it, quote, inherently improbable that Mr. Tudor believed he was granted, that he was either granted such authority or that he could reasonably believe that he had been given such broad powers, because his claim of such broad authority was at complete odds with the regs, the documents.
Mr. Solomson, apart from authority, whether or not there had been authority conveyed by Mr. Lasecki, I point you to, I want to have you look at the testimony that's in the supplemental appendix filed by Mr. Berger at A364. They're now talking to a Prigozhin, who's the deciding official.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he says, now, if you had concluded that Taylor or Lasecki was aware of what he was doing, exercising his authority, if they were just aware of what he was doing, would that have changed your opinion regarding sustaining reason one? Yes. So this doesn't go to whether or not Lasecki ever gave him any authority. They're saying to the deciding official, well, if, and this is pretty clear, if either Taylor or Lasecki was aware of what Tudor was doing and condoned that, would the penalty have been assessed? The answer is no.
Two responses, Your Honor. Mr.
Well,
Tudor does not.
Doesn't the record show without any question that both Taylor and Lasecki were aware of what Tudor was doing?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Is there any testimony that they were not aware of it?
There is.
Tudor testified that Taylor knew what he was doing. Clearly.
Generally. But Mr. Tudor conceded that he had no evidence that they were aware of the specific 64 cases that were the basis of the charge.
That's not the same thing. Were they aware of what he was doing, of what he was exercising? And Taylor testified, Tudor testified, I sat down with Taylor, went through all the cases. Did you, from that, did you believe that she must have known that you signed the forms? Absolutely, he said.
Your Honor, they're talking specifically at that transcript page about the specific instances, not as a general matter. They're talking about the specific forms of the 4930s.
How do we know that?
In the question on line 4.
Right, but they're just saying, were you aware of his exercise of approval authority, that the fact that he was signing the 4930s, right?
In this specific case.
And what would your answer be if the record, in fact, showed here, without any contrary evidence, that both Taylor and the SAC were aware of him signing the 4930s?
In these specific cases?
Just say, was aware. What I'm trying to get at is, here, the deciding official, when confronted with the possibility that the two bosses knew what he was doing and condoned it, he said, I wouldn't have punished him.
There's no evidence that they were aware that he signed these, all 64 of these, in particular with respect to the prosecution.
It doesn't say that he physically signed it. Was he exercised the authority that he was told that he shouldn't be doing was signing the form?
Well, aware of his approving activities to me means that he was aware of the specific activities that he was engaged in.
How do we know that? Did you ask that follow-up question?
Well, we know that because when Mr.
You didn't follow this up.
But on cross, Mr. Tudor himself conceded that he did not make them aware on a 4930 form-by-form basis.
He didn't say that. Where in the record did Tudor ever explicitly say that he did not show them a 4930?
I'd have to go to the complete volume.
Well, a pretty important point, isn't it, right on what we're talking about now? Have you listened to all the tape? Yes or no?
Have I listened to the tapes? No, but I read the complete transcript.
Think it might have been a good idea to listen to the tapes since you objected to the transcripts?
Well, Your Honor, we were just pressing the issue based on the rules of the court.
Right, but then in your brief, you never even bothered to respond to the lead argument from Mr. Tudor that the ALJ was wrong when he said this testimony was given.
Because the management inquiry and the testimony of Ms. King, which was unchallenged by the petitioner, is more than sufficient substantial evidence.
Okay, well, come back on this point. Where in the record is there an explicit admission by Mr. Tudor that he was asked the question, did you ever, you know, ask them whether they knew that you signed this particular 4930?
I have to ask for the court's indulgence for just a second.
I may have missed it, but I didn't see it. The questions were more general. Were the boss aware of what you were doing? Yep, sure were. Well, what were you doing?
I believe it's roughly on page 270 and 271 of the large transcript that the court admitted in the motion in the second.
270? Who's this, yours or his?
This was a the...
270 of the transcript.
Of the transcript.
Oh, pardon me. Okay. And where is that?
It's at page...
That's at page 413.
Actually, I'm not sure that's... You know what? I might not have the right...
413.
Okay. Here it is. It's on 278, Your Honor.
Well, yeah. Okay.
It's do you have personnel knowledge that he knew of each and every one of these 64 cases in which you were the approving official? Mr. Tudor responds, I would think so, yes. That's an assumption on your part, right? Yes. You had no direct conversation where he said, this case I give you approval, this case I give you my delegation, correct? And the conversation continues, but he agrees that he assumed that his superiors had such knowledge.
Well, when he was specifically asked, would you agree with me that you only informed them of specific verbal approval from Ms. Lisinski as to the three bulk initiative cases, he answered no. So, maybe that. All right, well, we have, I'm sorry, is that? Yeah. We've held you over time, and we'll hear rebuttal argument from Mr. Burke.
Very quickly, Your Honor. Yes, the management was wholly aware of Mr. Tudor's activities in referring cases. Let's very quickly start with page A65, blue appendix A65. SAC testified, Mr. Lisinski, he was continuously briefed about successful initiation and prosecution of cases, lines 13 through 17. On A79, the SAC testified that the ASAC told him that she was reviewing the group's work as well. On pages A66, A67, a specific reference to the 4930s is made, lines 10 through 20. SAC says, Mr. Lisinski, in all of these reviews, meaning the field office reviews, the management reviews.
All three of those reviews.
All three of those, not three cases. The reviews are listed on the page A66. If we take a quick look, line 6 through 22, there was a policy of the field office, two occasions per year, either the SAC or the ASAC would do a group review of the group, including a review of all the investigations that were initiated and prosecuted, line 12. In addition, once a year, the SAC supervisor, the director of field operations.
So that's what you say are the three.
There are three of them.
Reviews, not three cases. Right.
That's correct. There are three separate reviews. And he says,
understood,
on A67, lines 10 to 12, in all three of those reviews, there would have been reviews and assessments of the 4930s filed by Tudor. And he goes on to say,
he's asked whether, you know, if he signed them, would upper management have been aware of that? Is that correct? He answers yes on line 20, correct.
That's correct. And
so what do you make of the point that I was concerned about, which is laying aside the question of whether or not Lisinski gave him authority, the deciding official here, who is the chief high punisher, testified that if the Lisinski and or Taylor had been aware of what he was doing with regard to the 4930s, then he wouldn't have punished him. Is that an independent ground on which we can reverse here? Because passing the question of whether or not for the extent of the confusion in the record about the delegation of the authority, if the bosses knew what he was doing, even if he wasn't authorized.
I understood, and the court should defer to the agency deciding official on that issue. There, he's in the best position to know. And he says he wouldn't penalize his own employee had he properly understood that, in fact, Tudor had at least implied authority to do what he did with the knowledge of his management. And that's what the record clearly establishes in this case. After he had an opportunity of a full-blown evidentiary hearing with cross-examination and bringing his witnesses, as opposed to the management review, which was stilted, he's passive. He doesn't have a privilege of asking any questions. He can only respond to questions, and he has no idea what they're writing down. It is the board that is the best test of the truth because we have the benefit of cross-examination. And I ask that this court reverse this case, remand it, and let's get an appropriate, reasonable penalty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.